Blog Talk Radio.
Here comes a time of joy. Here comes a time of love. Here comes a time where wisdom shall fill up the earth. And one of the ways to prepare ourselves for that blessed time, we're talking about universal redemption. Kulim Mitzvos Shleim is the tuning into the higher inner frequency of Soul Class 391. Today's program is Secular by Design, Part 16. Good morning. My name is Donzi Sugubin. I am your friendly cyberspace Torah activist, Torah Askan. We're broadcasting live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA, Unifying Souls, actually, and it's about 10:02 right now, although we put in our promo, it would be starting at 9:30, we're actually starting at 10:02 right now, and program content will focus on reading a portion from Alan W. Cecil's book, Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances, which we highly recommend you purchase. You can go to Amazon.com and just type in Alan W. Cecil, Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide, that's N-O-A-H-I-D-E, Laws and Observances. And to help you prepare now for the program, the following question should be considered and meditated upon. Number one, how did the Big Bang get started? Number two, how should we consider cause and effect scenarios? Question three, what were unified into one force according to the speculations of scientists? Question four, according to scientists, what happened to the universe after it cooled? Question five, how can the Torah be understood as an authentic source for the depiction of the beginning of creation? And question six, who created all matter that exists in the entire universe? Meanwhile, may the eternal creator bless you and your loved ones peacefully and pleasantly. Our call-in number is 347-838-8669. And in fact, in a few minutes, hopefully, Alan W. Cecil will be joining us live. But as a special treat as well, we have on our program right now, Rambam teacher, student, activist, and advocate for the dissemination of teachings of Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, Maimonides, Dennis Ryan. Good morning, Dennis, as we bring on Alan as well.
Good morning. Okay,
good morning.
Good job. Alan, we have Dennis Ryan on, and Dennis, we have Alan on. So, gentlemen.
Hey, Alan.
Hey, Dennis, how you doing?
Okay.
It's a pleasure to have you both. And I mentioned to Dennis, Alan, before the program, and I'll tell you, I'm not publicly ashamed. This portion of the book, I'm a little bit intimidated of because the areas of science that you are dealing with, I am not necessarily too schooled in it, but I looked up some definitions, and maybe you can break it down further as we try to make our way through reading in your part one overview. But of course, Blessed Souls, the reason why Alan has integrated such, say, intellectually dense material and connected to this book, Secular by Design, A Philosophy with No Laws and Observances, is to show that a person, a Ben Noah, and a Jew, such as, say, myself and Alan, and especially Alan, can in fact learn Torah and look at concepts in science and not see a contradiction. On the other hand, those scientists who reject Torah as an authentic piece of scholarship, and we would humbly remind everyone it's a piece of divine scholarship, that they somehow see Torah not in the realm of something which is up to par with their intellectual perceptions. So before we go further, I just want to do a brief review of something that Alan brought out from the program we did last week, that according to the standard model of physics, first proposed in the 1970s, there are four fundamental forces that influence entities called particles. There's the strong force, the weak force, the electromagnetic force, and the gravitational force. The strong force holds the nucleus of the atom together. The weak force holds the particles together in the protons and neutrons. The electromagnetic force holds atoms and molecules together, and the gravitational force, the weakest of the four fundamental forces, yet this force, which causes particles of mass to be attracted to one another, that is the gravitational force, and which is necessary to hold large objects such as stars and galaxies
right
together. Now, starting off where we're picking up now today from the second half of page 41 from part one overview from Alan's book, the quote-unquote Big Bang started when an indescribable amount of the subatomic particles suddenly appeared, and we will have to suspend our understanding of the laws of causality and entropy for a moment. Now, I'm just pulling out from abouteducation.com or about.com that entropy is a quantitative measure of disorder in a system. The concept comes out of thermodynamics, which deals with the transfer of heat energy within a system. Instead of talking about some form of absolute entropy, physicists generally talk about the change in entropy which takes place in a specific thermodynamic process. But before we go any further, blessed souls, the question is, who created the system to allow the concept in physics of disorder to take place? And Alan, it seems that scientists just take it as a given. Or Dennis, I'll ask you both to comment on this. Why did they take it as a given? Well, any system must have a systems designer. Ellen, your take on this matter.
Well, I guess they believe Harry Potter did it. It just, you know, they he just waved his wand and boom, all this, you know, matter and energy appeared. They don't have any explanation.
Dennis, how can scientists come up with a system without... And then forget about there must have been a designer of the system. I mean, scientists are designers of systems, which they apply theories and hypotheses and conclusions, and then they can implement it in practical action. Why are they forgetting about the designer of the system while coming with all these intellectual complexities about the beginning of creation? Dennis.
Don, yes. That's because
yes,
scientists are human, imperfect, and they're looking from their eyes outward, since they cannot look from the beginning inward. So therefore, they don't want to say they believe in God because they only believe what their senses tell them. While God doesn't worry about senses because he's everything, he is all. So therefore, in our imperfect world, don't expect perfection.
Mm-hmm. Now, Alan mentioned on page 41 this idea of in the parenthetical thought, and we will have to suspend our understanding of the laws of causality. And then he brings in footnote 20, quoting from Rav Hirsch, the Hirsch Psalms, page 420, that the forces of cause and effect, which are godlike and therefore worshipped by men, were conferred by the Creator upon the realm of nature. Now, this is a very fascinating topic to me, blessed souls, because I, as a learner of Hasidus, am well acquainted with what is known as Iluva Olo, cause and effect, and there's a whole realm, there's a whole universe of teachings of what brought about cause and effect in the creation. But the thing that Rav Hirsch brings up, which is very interesting, is that unfortunately, people got caught up, and I guess scientists as well, because they are people. Scientists, we should maybe make a bumper sticker. Scientists are human as well. That people started to worship forces of cause and effect, like the sun and the moon. Well, on the other hand, say pertaining to like the seven Noahide commandments, if only human beings would give these divine commandments a chance, they would see the forces of cause and effect in terms of stabilizing the creation, in terms of educating masses of human beings not to commit murder, not to steal, not to commit adultery, not to blaspheme God, not to eat the limb of an animal that's still alive, not to commit adultery, to not to eat the limb of an animal while the animal's still alive, and to create systems of court systems, which are really basically the flip side of a court system, is a system of administering the education of them to the masses, that they can see the cause and effect of a stabilized creation by adhering to these commandments. Alan, any comments on this and the fact that, and to our great pain, that human beings are not studying the cause and effect of the positivity that could transpire if they would adhere to the seven Noahide commandments?
Well, it touches on something we talked about last week about the essence of matter. All these little particles are, you know, scientists say that they really have no mass. Everything is held together by these four elemental forces, which they have absolutely no explanation of where these forces came from. They don't even try. And, you know, if you think about it, you know, the essence of our time, I mean, everything is held together by these four forces, which, you know, as I mentioned a little later in the book, you know, that you know, you have these four forces. Actually, it's really interesting. They said that in the very beginning of creation, these four forces were combined into one force.
Right, which I'm going to read right now from your book. Scientists speculate that all four fundamental forces were unified into one single force, and as the proto-matter expanded and cooled, the forces became separate. After a couple of minutes, the universe, that's interesting, after how they calculate it was a couple of minutes, the universe had cooled off enough to let the newly formed neutrons and protons to stick together. And after about 10,000 years, I thought it was always 9,998 years and 25 seconds, that's a joke by mine, the universe cooled and expanded some more. Then after about 300,000 years, which no one really has even ever calculated in real time, 300,000 years, let alone, you know, live to see 300,000 years, the universe had cooled off enough for the electrons to be captured by the protons to form hydrogen, the most basic of matter. So the electrons to this point in time had rendered the matter opaque due to their interaction with photons, but now for the first time, light as we know it could be seen. Now this is how most of the scientists and physicists understand the beginnings of the universe and the creation of matter, and I guess they also read a lot of Harry Potter. How different how modern this view is compared to the account from the King James Bible above. But now we're going to turn to the Hebrew Torah and the classic commentators of Judaic teachings, many of whom explained creation long before the telescope was invented and long before secular science was able to explain the origins of the universe. And we're going to segue now to footnote 21, which Alan listed on page 42 of Secular by Design, Part 1, the overview. The Torah harbors the general theory for the totality of existence. Of course, we do not mean the Torah as ordinarily read or studied. We mean the Torah understood as written in code language, a language in which every letter has a mathematical and ideographic significance. We mean the Torah whose narratives and precepts harbor hidden wisdom, the decodification of which requires the application of certain mathematical and logical rules on the one hand, and the knowledge of the sciences on the other. And that was written by Professor, I think his name is Paul Eidelberg, in his book, Jerusalem versus Athens. So, Alan, I'm going to turn to you because I know this is something where you really have a niche in connecting, you know, in the process of educating people that you just can't read the Torah literally because there's a whole system of codification and implication and hinting to and ethical teachings as well as the Kabbalistic Hasidic parts of it, not meaning the secrets of it. And this is why scientists brush over just the English or the Latin translation, because it's like basically me looking into a chemistry book and saying, oh, it looks like a nice recipe for a chocolate cake, but actually it's talking about how to make an atom bomb.
The scientists only know the literal meaning, and they disparage the theological meaning, since that is the only interpretation they're aware of. So that is the problem. They don't understand all the different layers underneath that we're able to get out of the Hebrew text.
Right. So proceeding further, we're going to go now, as Alan listed, the first six verses of Genesis, which is also mentioned as Bereshis, with an English translation that's unfamiliar to the majority of human beings upon the planet. So I'm not going to read it in the Hebrew. I'm just going to read the translation as Alan rendered it, which is very interesting how he did it. In the beginning of God's creating space and matter, which is basically indicating that where it's written in the Torah, the Bible, where he created heaven, that's referring to space because of the wide expansiveness, I guess. If you look into the heaven, it seems never to end. And then the earth, that's referring to matter. So the first verse is indicating that the Creator allowed to permeate into the universe that he had designed the aspect of space and matter, because previous to, as testified to us in this first verse in the Torah, space and matter did not exist. Now, as well, in the second verse, Alan had it translated out as, when matter was without substance and darkness was on the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God hovered on the surface of the waters. So in terms of the Spirit of God, there was nothing new about that, because the Spirit of God existed before there was matter, or matter without substance, and then matter with substance, or darkness, which was upon the surface of the deep. By the third verse, Alan recorded it as, God said, let there be light, and there was light. So there was no indication that there was a sun yet, or even moonlight, or planetary starlight, but yet we're talking about the Creator said, let there be light. Verse 4, God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the dark matter, meaning matter's entities which were devoid of this light. And verse 5, God called to the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, and there was morning one day. And then the sixth verse, which is also something, the implications of a firmament, as indicated in this verse, where it says, God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the seas, or it can also be translated as midst of the waters, and let it be separate between sea and sea. There is an, all puns intended, there is a sea or an ocean's amount of material that one can learn about. What is the implication of the fact that there is a firmament that has divided up water? Also, here we see the first indication that there is a legitimacy to the idea of a separation sometimes is needed for the sake of creating ultimately a greater sense of awareness, why there have to be borders, why there have to be demarcated lines, not only in the creation, but even ultimately in human behavior, which a lot of people grapple at, and probably all of us in our lives grapple at one point or another, why we have to do something this way or one way as opposed to another way. Before I turn to Alan and Dennis, I'm just going to read here this last short paragraph. To grasp the beginning of Genesis can be translated this way from the original Hebrew, we look no further than the explanations from the classic rabbinical commentators to the Hebrew text. But I want to now turn to, say, Dennis and then Alan about how there are subtle implications here which, when taken from the context of the traditional understanding of these first six verses in creation, that if the nuances aren't picked up within the context on how the Torah was originally given, then people could be just like reading this and thinking it's some sort of just historical depiction, as opposed to there's tremendous instruction here if a person wants to adhere to that instruction. Dennis, any take on these matters, comments, questions, or concerns?
Yes, it's not subtle at all, Don, as you called it. You got to remember, humans are still trying to figure out the chicken and the egg, which came first. Right. We haven't figured that out. However, in the beginning, what God did, humans are still trying to come up with theories. And we have theories and theories and theories. History has shown us that everybody has their own opinion and they can have their own theory. But if your faith and belief is strong enough, you will believe in what God did. And he encompassed all those theories.
Beautiful, Dennis. Alan, your take on this, how by your... I mean, let me ask you this, Alan. How did you, when you realized that there are different implications on how it could be understood, this depiction in Genesis of Bereshis in the light of Torah, did it open up a door for you to understand perhaps how most people are just kind of like skimming over these verses and saying, okay, so what does it say in the next chapter?
Yeah, well, this is one of the key things that got me into the Noahide Law in the first place, that when I started to understand how when you go past the literal meaning, which everybody's read and jokes about, and understand that, you know, the sages and the rabbis talked about concepts that the rest of mankind didn't come up with until just the last couple of centuries, you know, it's pretty amazing. I mean, to me, that was a pretty logical proof that, you know, there was something to this. There was something deeper in the verses. And, you know, when you start studying, seeing how they're able to extract this knowledge using systems of rabbinical hermeneutics, you know, that's what got me really impressed.
True. And from a scientific perspective, if we look from within the context how you describe these verses, Alan, but the fact that there's the acknowledgement from within the Torah that Creator God created space and matter, well, that opens up the door for scientific thinking. Well, let's study this space and let's study this matter. And what we can understand of space, let's understand it, and let's understand matter, and let that be a testimony to the care and the consideration and the grace and the mercy that the creation has placed upon this creation, that we as his children, as all people are children of the Most High, emanating back to original man and woman, Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava, that we can understand by which how much care he gave or consideration that he would allow us to actually investigate and try to better understand him by understanding not the essence of him, but some of his attributes, not all of them, but some of his attributes, that he allows us to understand that we are dwelling within his creation, and the idea of light and darkness and firmament and water. We see that every one of these matters mentioned in the Spirit of God, all of these matters have been the subject of intellectual discernment and debate, which is a healthy thing. This is a type of Talmudic reasoning. But unfortunately, if people go outside of the Torah perspective, and they forget about God, then it just becomes secular thinking, and then unfortunately, it becomes a matter for some scientists to justify dissing or discarding the very source of their scientific endeavors, which the Torah has mandated that human beings can in fact investigate this creation to further appreciate the kindness of the Creator for creating such stuff that we're dwelling in. Alan?
Well, that is true. I would also like to point out that this section of the Torah is so important because it is one of the main focuses of attack from the secular intellectual atheist community. And again, what they're attacking is the literal meaning and the Christian interpretation. They don't know what the rabbis knew.
Mm-hmm. That being said, we're going to go now to the last section that I'll be reading from today, from the very first verse of the Bible, the Torah, in the beginning of God's creating space and matter. The beginning of the Torah is one of the most famous verses of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. This is something similar, such as the heavens and the earth, is the familiar opening to the Christian Bibles. The English translation in Jewish Bibles, on the other hand, phrases it differently. In the beginning of God's creating the heavens and the earth, which is, and that there's a footnote there, 22, which Alan is pulling from art school, the art school Chumash, or from the beginning did God create the heaven and the earth, and this he was quoting from Rav Hirsch's Truma Tzvi. What this means is that God created all matter that exists in the universe, and the fact that the Creator has manifested or created this matter and everything in the universe, this is something which scientists have a lot of trouble dealing with. Again, the system's designer. But this is what the first verses in the Torah are indicating to us, that all form of matter, and we can also say space, and light, and spirit, and firmament, came in into being because a creator allowed matter to exist. Remember, Blessed, we of the monotheistic creed or faith, you might call it the Judaic, Noahide faith, do not believe that the creator is a tangible being in the sense that we can grasp him, or he has more than one body. He does not have a body. He's the source of all forms of body. Now, we have about 4 minutes to go, so I'll allow Dennis and then Alan to make concluding remarks about the need for, if they feel it is the need for humans to revisit the book of Genesis, to realize that there's not only outright instruction about the beginning of the creation, but certainly permissibility as well for human beings to go into the scientific endeavors to discover how vast and how acutely specific the creation is, which all testifies to a systems designer, as we would like to say, a divine systems designer. Dennis?
Yes, I personally believe that the religious thinkers over history, which includes all of Scripture, have a better idea or understanding of God's plan, of how he created the universe, the earth, and everything else part of it. The other people who don't start with that as a premise, but start with themselves and based on what they believe they have developed, come out with stuff that sounds a little off the wall. And it, to me, it's hard to have faith in their theories when they're not God-oriented.
Thank you, Dennis. Alan, any final take before we close out the show?
Well, just the fact that the very first verse of the Torah has been so misunderstood and mistranslated. The famous Christian Bible, you know, it says, in the beginning, comma, God created the heavens and the earth. It, the way that it's translated in the Jewish texts, you know, in the beginning of God's creation, or from the beginning, the Hebrew subtly implies there was an existence before the universe was created.
Which Rambam indicates in the laws of the fundamentals, the foundations of the Torah, is that it was a Matzi Rishon, there was a first being. And even that is just alluding to the Creator, who is even beyond. I mean, sometimes the Lubavitch Rebbe, his merits be a source of protection for us, mentioned he coined Hashem, God, as a super being. But again, Creator is not even a super being, but he spoke in the language, or the Torah speaks in the language of man, that our ears can inculcate something of an instruction, the way our minds are calibrated, that we can formulate that there is something who is not only a being who is super or a supreme being, but even he's more than that. And this is, we've had a very, I would say, intellectually dense and fascinating and stimulating conversation this morning with Dennis Ryan and author Alan W. Cecil of Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws. I'd like to thank you both gentlemen for coming on today. And what... any last piece of advice for our listening audience, Dennis and Alan, before I turn to our flagship ending music by Brother David Dome? Dennis?
Yes, hang in there with the scripture, because no one has written anything that's going to supersede it.
Okay. Alan?
The same thing. Study Torah.
Well,
I'm going
to
be like Rashi, just
me.
Nice and concise.
Okay, so that being said, we're going to now turn to our friend from England, David Dome, who will help us get back home, to help us realize our Tzelem Elokim, it is no dream, our divine image, will help us get off and scrimmage, as my wife tries to call me in before I end the show. That's okay, because she's in the know that I know that she has to tell me something, and while I'm about to answer the phone for my wife, we're going to be playing By the Grace of God by David Dome. Just remember, blessed souls, that before we turn on the music, you've got to be good, because you are good, because you have that Nesinus Kol, that you've been empowered by the Creator to be good, because the teva tov lehetiv is the nature of the good to do good. Therefore, it's in your DNA, it's in your particles, it's in your electrons, it's in your neutrons, it's in your gravitational force, it's in your force, it's in your strong force, it's in you. By the grace of God, go I. By David Dom. Take care, everyone.
I've been strong.